Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Join us for an in-depth look at Iowa agriculture. Here are your hosts, Anna Hastert and Dustin Hoffman.
Happy Saturday or happy Sunday. Thanks for tuning in to Weekend Ag Matters here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. I'm Anna Hastert, your host this week, joined by Dustin Hoffman. We're gearing up for the holiday break here at the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Don't worry, we will still have programming for you as we head into the new year, and we'll have programming well into the new year. But Dustin, talking about programming, what were some of the topics that we covered here at the network this past week?
You know, we're really earning our Christmas break here this week. We had two big things happen on Thursday. We, of course, had USMCA finally pass the House. You did some coverage on that, and I happened to be able to talk with Senator Ernst that afternoon just before it passed. But also the RFS, the supplemental rule we've been waiting for from the EPA, it came out. It wasn't what we were hoping for by any means. It was exactly what they said they were going to do. Even after the comment period and the listening sessions, they didn't change their position one iota. And again, was very disappointing. Many ag groups said that the EPA and trust don't seem to go together anymore. Senator Ernst even said that the EPA had the chance to restore the farmers' trust in the organization, and they completely missed the mark. So definitely not some good news there, but we do have an answer.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, Dustin, earlier, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement has passed the House of Representatives. We'll head to the Senate, expecting to vote on that early next year. But talking about next year, in my segment this week, I talked to David Herring, who is president of the National Pork Producers Council, about some of the things that went well for pork producers in 2019, as well as some things that were kind of weighing that industry down. But we talk about some things that they're also working for heading into the new year. So let's kick it over to David Herring, president of the National Pork Producers Council.
2019 was a year full of challenges, said David Herring, president of the National Pork Producers Council. However, Herring believes United States pork producers are in a better environment than they were this time last year. He speaks to efforts pushing them forward into the new year.
NPPC enters 2020 with a full issue agenda and a unified group of pork producers ready to fight for expanded export opportunities and reasonable legislation and common sense regulations. We head into 2020 with some momentum thanks to successes on many fronts. I'd like to highlight a few. NPPC was relentless in its push to end the metal tariff dispute with Mexico. NPPC made it widely known that U.S. pork producers were at the tip of the trade retaliation spear to the tune of a $12 loss per hog from Mexico's 20% tariffs. We were thrilled when these tariffs were lifted in May and the subsequent movement of the USMCA trade agreement. USMCA and the preservation of long-term zero-tariff pork trade in North America was another cause for celebration, and we look forward to seeing the president sign it into law early next year. Another tremendous win for U.S. pork producers this year was the signing of the U.S.-Japan trade deal. Shortly following the 2016 election, when it became clear that TPP was not in the cards for the United States, NPPC advanced an advocacy strategy in Washington and Tokyo that resulted in a critical early harvest trade deal with Japan that puts U.S. pork producers back on a level playing field with international competitors. Japan is our largest export market by value, so completing a fast deal with Japan was critical, particularly after the EU and the TPP-11 nations gained more favorable access earlier this year. Along with NPPC, President-elect A.V. Roth and NPPC Vice President Nick Giordano, I was proud to join President Trump for the signing of an agreement that economists say will allow us to grow U.S. pork exports to Japan by nearly 40% over the next 15 years. In 2019, NPPC also worked to ensure that cell culture protein falls under the same regulatory oversight faced by the real meat it seeks to mimic. That's all we ask when it comes to alternative proteins, a level playing field. We brought serious scrutiny to the FDA's regulatory land grab of gene-edited livestock, setting the stage for oversight to be moved to the USDA, a critical matter if we are to keep America first in agriculture. We also successfully advocated for the common sense restoration of the farm exemption for routine admissions. We urge the introduction of legislation to increase the number of agriculture inspectors at our ports and secured a USDA grant to gain better understanding of African swine fever through research in an ASF-positive country, Vietnam. And we secured transportation regulations for the unique animal welfare requirements for livestock hauling. It was a challenging but productive year. Let's turn to 2020 and our priorities and what promises to be another eventful year for MPPC. They say defense wins championships. Frankly, when it comes to trade, we're tired of playing defense and hope 2020 is a year of progress built on strong offensive performance. We were very pleased with last week's announcement of a Phase 1 trade deal that will reportedly benefit U.S. pork. We look forward to the details of this agreement. China represents an unparalleled opportunity for U.S. pork producers to provide the highest quality and most affordable pork in the world. It's no secret that China needs reliable, affordable sources of pork. No source is better positioned to meet this need than American hog farmers. According to Iowa State University economist Dermot Hayes, the United States, if it gained unrestricted access to the Chinese market, would reduce the overall trade deficit with China by nearly 6%, generate 184,000 new U.S. jobs, and produce $24.5 billion in new sales all in the next decade. Additionally, with ASF spreading in many parts of Asia, MPPC hopes to expand export opportunities in the Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, and other countries. Pork is the preferred protein in these countries, and our growth opportunities are significant. Turning to domestic issues, MPPC's top priority for 2020 is continued vigilance to ensure ASF and other foreign animal diseases do not enter our country. I'd like to thank the USDA and Customs and Border Protection for their strong collaboration in responding to this increased risk. We are in a better position today than we were a year ago. More can be done, and MPPC is pushing for 600 new agriculture inspectors at our borders to bring the total number to 3,000. We were very pleased when the House approved yesterday, as part of the 2020 Department of Homeland Security Appropriations Bill, an additional $19.6 million in funding for more agriculture inspectors at our ports to prevent African swine fever and other foreign animal diseases from entering the United States. In October, the full Senate unanimously approved legislation which authorizes the annual hiring of 240 agriculture specialists and 200 agricultural technicians each fiscal year until the shortage is filled. We support the Senate's bill as well as a companion version introduced by Representative Vila in the House, and will work to ensure passage in the coming year. MPPC's foreign animal disease preparedness efforts also include the fast establishment by the USDA of a foot and mouth disease vaccine bank, as prescribed by the 2018 Farm Bill. Unlike ASF, vaccines can be used to quickly contain and eradicate FMD. Unfortunately, the United States currently doesn't have access to enough vaccine to deal with even a small outbreak. Our science and technology team will also continue work with the administration to establish regulatory oversight of gene-edited livestock with the USDA. Gene editing introduces useful genetic variation into food animal breeding programs, promising significant animal health benefits, including a natural immunity to disease and a reduction in the need to use antibiotics. While countries like Canada, Brazil, and Argentina are moving quickly on this advancement to gain competitive advantage, the United States is falling behind because of the FDA's impractical regulatory approach is cumbersome, lengthy, and expensive. It will render technology unavailable to U.S. livestock agriculture and undermine its competitive position globally. USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is the agency best prepared to regulate gene editing and realizes its enormous promise. We're hopeful for a positive resolution by early next year. These are just a few of NPPC's top priorities for 2020. Others include finding solutions for livestock agriculture's labor shortage, advancing our legal challenge against Proposition 12 in California, and reauthorization of the Livestock Mandatory Reporting Act. I am confident that NPPC will successfully face these and other issues of importance for U.S. pork.
That was David Herring, president of the National Pork Producers Council. Stay tuned to Week in Ag Matters for more news and information.
In this snowy winter season, may we also realize the joy of the Christmas season, a time of giving, seeing friends, relatives, and all those we love, a chance to do a good deed or a charitable act. Most of all, a time to celebrate the reason for the season. From Anna Hastert, Dustin Hoffman, Russ Parker, Emery Clavin, and me, Ken Root, Merry Christmas from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Here's your host, Dustin Hoffman.
As we get into the Christmas spirit this time of year, it's sometimes hard to do when you see more brown on the ground than you do with snow, especially when you have temperatures that keep the snow from staying for any length of time. But on Monday, I got the chance to drive out to the Miller Tree Farm out by Runnels, Iowa. The snow that fell on Sunday night was still hanging on the trees and around the farm. It was there that I got to hear a story of a 65-year-old tree farm still keeping traditions alive in central Iowa.
I am out at the Miller Tree Farm, and I'm talking with Jill Brady. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us today.
No problem at all.
So tell us a little bit, first of all, about the history of the Miller Tree Farm out here, out by Runnels here.
Well, my dad started planting trees 65 years ago in 1954. That's when he had his first child, so he wanted to he worked for John Deere, supplement his income and have something for the whole family to work on. He's been selling trees for the last 65 years, and it's been a family affair. I have two brothers and a sister, and it's just part of our Christmas. And my dad was a very strong Christian. We lost him this year. But he was a very strong Christian, so he liked to bring the reason for the season into the Christmas tree business. He made quite a reputation. He really cared about people and helped a lot of people start some tree farms around the area, actually.
All right. So tell us about how many acres does your tree farm encompass?
Well, the tree farm is probably only about 20 acres, but he has about 40 acres in the area.
Okay. And so you said for 65 years, has it grown over that time? Have you accumulated more land to put into production for the trees? Or has it been as it's grown as you've been producing more trees?
Actually, probably producing less trees because the deer have found the fields. So they take a lot of our trees every year. And my dad was a very strong forestry person. So he likes to leave a lot of the bigger trees and let them grow. He has some that are, 60, 70 years old in the fields.
So obviously, like you said, you're talking about the forestry, it's about leaving some, but being able to take some, for the health of the trees to control that population as well, correct?
Yes. He always says when people with the forestry aspect, he was always, why don't you let all the trees grow? And his answer was always, if he didn't have a few cut down as Christmas trees, he couldn't afford to keep the land. And he really loved nature and the land, and he always keeps a lot of them still growing.
And is it also not good for the trees that are left behind, these 60, 70-year-old trees, to get sometimes some of these younger ones thinned out, or ones that maybe wouldn't have that chance to get to that age as well because of the population out there?
Oh, it's very hard. It's not good for the tree farm to let some of them get really big because the trees don't grow underneath the big trees very well. But that was just my dad. That was part of his reason for growing them, was to create a forest. He loved Colorado, and he used to bring different seed sources from around the United States back and try to grow them on the tree farm.
So how many different varieties would you say are out here on the farm, or at least the ones that you bring out, or is there just too many to count?
There's quite a few because he always tried unusual species, but mostly it's Fraser fir, white pine, red pine, Scotch pine, probably five, six different species.
So, Christmas tree farms seem to get a lot of attention this time of year. That's why we're out doing this today. But Christmas tree farming is a whole year-round practice to make sure these trees are taken care of. What does it take? Once this Christmas season winds down, what's the next thing in line for you guys to be doing?
It's a lot of work. I don't think people really realize how much work it is, and you're all right. It's a year-round thing. The first thing we'll do is go through and clean up the fields, which will cut the stumps to the ground. Of course, in the spring we plant, and then in the summer you have to trim them. There's a lot of spraying that's involved if you get different diseases in the trees.
What is some of the biggest challenges you see throughout the year, especially in the spring and summer when you're talking disease and pests out there?
Our biggest problem right now is deer. And if you walk through the field, you'll see a lot of the trees, they'll be all scraped up. And at one of the farm places, they border Yellowbank State Park. And so the deer come from the park and just love the trees.
So how long does it take for a tree to get to the size it needs to be for what you'd see as a typical Christmas tree? Now, I know you'll see all different sizes out there, but for a typical average tree, what would you say the time is?
Pretty much like a pine, that's the fastest growing trees. They like 6 to 8 years would probably get you a tree that would 6 foot tree in a house. If you're talking the firs, they grow a lot slower. It's probably 8 to 10 years to get a normal size tree for a house.
So when your father started this, how long did it take for him to be able to start selling trees? And you know, since it's been 65 years with the woods around here, then we'll get some pictures up on the website as well. There's obviously trees around here, so there was some, I'm sure, available right away. But how long did it take to establish a farm where he was producing? Was it that 6 to 7 years?
It actually wasn't even that long because it was really interesting. He had an agreement with Iowa State University when he planted all of his fields. They used to come down with huge trucks and buy the 3 foot trees for the kids in the campus. So he started selling probably within 4 or 5 years of when he started planting.
Oh, that's good. And so besides the trees, I see you have wreaths and all kinds of things out here for sale as well.
Right. We have wreaths and swags. My brother and my daughter, they do arrangements and things like that. We have stands. About anything you would need for the tree business.
So when you're making a wreath, how does that come about? Is it from trimmings from the trees, or is it just part of the trees that maybe aren't quite Christmas tree shaped or material? Is that how it goes?
Yeah, it's trees that didn't quite make the quality for a Christmas tree. So we go in the field and we cut them down, and then my brother makes wreaths. He makes them every day. We usually start a week or two before Thanksgiving making the wreaths.
So as you look at the Christmas tree industry as a whole, how do you feel about it here as we sit in 2019?
Well, in this area, the number of tree farms has been going down every year. I don't think people realize how much work it is. It's a lot of work, and you can spend years working on a tree, and then a deer can come through and break it, or it can get a disease. I don't know. They're definitely going out of style, the Christmas tree farms.
Are you still seeing that loyal customer base, though, that still wants that tree, that wants that natural tree in the house?
Oh, yes. We had a lot of people last weekend that had been here over 45 years coming. And that's one thing Dad was really proud of, because he had actually grandchildren of the original people that had families of their own that were coming out. And he valued that trade a lot, that it was repeat customers. And they all knew Dad because he had red hair. So it's a family. I mean, we're all a family, even though there are other people helping us in the season. It's still just a big family.
It's a family farm, a family production operation, producing for all these families that are coming all year round.
Right.
So if people, is it strictly trees that have been pre-cut, or do people have the option of cutting their own? How does that work?
We have both here at the farm. We have this small field, and we have a bigger field down the road where you can choose and cut your own. A lot of people want to do that. The fields aren't really just keeping up with that. So we do have other fields that we cut from here to the house. My brother has a big farm in Norwalk, and so we do cut some and bring here to the house. So it's about half and half on how many cut their own.
You see the younger generation still embracing that, wanting to go out and cut their own tree, or seeing some people trying to reestablish some of those older traditions?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I wish we had a big enough field that everybody could go cut their own, because that's obviously the ultimate. We have a lot of people that come when they first have new families, and then we don't see them for a few years, and then they're back again with their grandkids. So it's definitely a tradition.
All right. If people want more information on Miller's Tree Farm out here and want to find out about you, how do they find out about you?
The phone number is 515-710-5691, and the website MillerTreeFarm.com.
Well, Jill, I thank you very much for taking the time to visit with us and tell the story about your family farm.
Thank you.
That again was Jill Brady with the Miller Tree Farm out by Runnels, Iowa. We'll be back on Weekend Ag Matters right after the break.
Keeping up on the latest in ag is a challenge, to say the least, but there are experts nearby ready to help. You'll find them at your local FS. You can trust them to bring you customized agronomic, grain, and energy solutions born of the latest thinking. That's because FS specialists receive continuous training that keeps them current on the latest trends, practices, and technologies. So you'll get local expertise that's both exceptional and up-to-date. Visit fssystem.com to learn how FS is bringing you what's next.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters, and now, here's Ken Root.
The United States is a trading nation. We have the wonderful asset of being able to produce much more than we use. In agriculture, it's translated to food and fiber. We have the ability to grow much more cotton, corn, soybeans, rice, and wheat, among other crops, than our economy can consume. But we've always had the temptation to restrict our exports in order to change the behavior of a foreign nation. In modern times, it began with the Soviet Union. President Jimmy Carter launched a grain embargo in 1979 against the Soviet Union that was triggered by their invasion of Afghanistan. It was a typical Western response to a political threat from a defined adversary. Our action against the Russians was followed by their action against us, and we can say today that both sides lost. More importantly, the people of many nations were adversely impacted by market reaction. In the United States, the grain embargo was one of a number of elements that caused good times in agriculture of the 1970s to end. We cannot discount intervention by the Federal Reserve to stop inflation and the resulting meteoric rise in interest rates, but it just takes a small imbalance in the marketplace to set off a major correction. Dissecting the U.S. reaction to the Soviet entry into Afghanistan in 1979, there was a great deal of information that came to light later that indicated Carter's advisors and his moralist stance caused the wrong pathway to be taken. According to former USDA Secretary Bob Berglund, the Soviets came to the U.S. to tell top security officials of their intentions to invade Afghanistan. We rejected their claim that they were going after Islamic extremists. We saw it as an empire expansion and a desire to transplant communism into another nation. Berglund, speaking in 2003, stated the grain embargo didn't work and the Carter administration should have let the Soviets do us a favor and stop a problem we didn't know existed until the World Trade Centers were destroyed in 2001. The question is when a nation should stand against another and when to show restraint. The British failed to confront Hitler in the 1930s, and he tried to destroy them soon after. In 1980, we tried to counter the Soviet Afghanistan expedition. We failed miserably and are still in Afghanistan with military forces. There are no easy answers in our political system because it doesn't select a president based on foreign relations finesse nor military skill. I contend that trade is a pathway to peace. It has its pitfalls, but generally the desire to have an economic exchange with another nation benefits both. When wars end, the first bridge built back between the countries is trade. Japan came back from the devastation of World War II to be one of the world's strongest economic powers because of trade. China, in the post-Mao era, has become an example of how trade can elevate a nation rapidly, but does not necessarily change the philosophy of the government. The Soviet Union bought grain from the United States during the worst period of the Cold War, while both nations pointed missiles at each other. If history bears out, based on past embargoes, artificial restraint of trade will be short-lived. The ability of channeling money and goods into a market will be quickly exploited by enterprising companies and nations. The long-term damage will be on trust between the countries that are in dispute. Once a government shows it will disrupt commerce for political principles, it may stand taller in its own eyes, but economic erosion begins and often lasts for a generation. In the words of a Carter advisor who was party to the anti-Soviet actions of the late 1970s, quote, "We just couldn't let them go into a country and then belly up to the bar like nothing had changed." He was speaking of Afghanistan and trade. I admire the charisma of that statement, but I dislike the economic outcome. We have to accept that a number of countries are at risk today. Ukraine might lose its sovereignty in the near future. Actions by Europe, Canada, and the U.S. are not certain, and neither is the outcome of any realignment of power. No one wants to see people oppressed by their own government or an invader, but we have to coexist in an imperfect world. Trade is a universal language that can tie nations together. Let's hope, in all cases, we can keep talking and avoid any hostile outcome. I'm Ken Root on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Thank you, Ken, and that's all for this edition of Weekend Ag Matters. We thank you for tuning in with us here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. You can find replays of this show as well as all of our other content online at iowaagnet.com. Don't forget to find us on Twitter and Facebook at Iowa Ag Radio. On behalf of myself, Anna Hastert, and Ken Root, we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on Weekend Ag Matters.